Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Migration season is energizing bird watchers from across the country. Millions of our feathered friends head south this fall, offering some of the most radiant and glorious spectacles in the sky. There are all sorts of variables that make bird migration a sophisticated science. For example, different types of birds will fly at varying heights and speeds. Songbirds travel 20 to 30 miles per hour on average. Waterfowl and shorebirds will fly 30 to 50 miles per hour. Certain birds fly longer distances before needing to break for food. Some birds fly during the day, while others prefer the evening. Migration can also be very predictable, as many species will travel the same route and depart at roughly the same time every year. But there are also many challenges and risks during migration, such as the threat of predators, parasites, and pathogens. It can be a highly stressful and sometimes even dangerous expedition. And then there's also the problem of humans. On today's Your Call, we're going to be talking about bird migration and also what we can do to make sure we don't affect that migration pattern. What role do we play in increasing the dangers birds face while migrating? How do we create a world where we don't disrupt this natural flow? What are some of the conditions of the waterfowl habitats and estuaries in Northern California that birds rely upon during their migration? And also, how does global warming impact all of this? Joining me here in studio is Beth Hunning. She's coordinator of the San Francisco Bay Joint Venture. That's a partnership for restoring habitat for birds and wildlife. Hi, Beth. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by Brad Bortner. He's Chief Division of Migratory Birds and Habitat Programs of the Pacific Region U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And Brad joins us on the line from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Brad. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. So first off, very simple question, Beth. Why do birds migrate?
Birds migrate primarily, it's a matter of energetics, of food, and what they're doing is taking advantage of the best food source. For instance, a lot of the birds will migrate to the Arctic. We often think about the birds living in the Arctic and migrating down here, but quite often it's the other way around. They're living in the more southern climes and then migrating to breed, because during the summer seasons when there's long light, there's a lot of food availability up there. It helps them increase their nesting so that they can produce a higher number of chicks in the brood. And then they will migrate as the temperature changes, the climate gets colder, and they come back to more southern climates where there's a year-round stability of food.
And Brad, is this the best time of the year for bird lovers?
This is an excellent time of the year. Large numbers of birds are moving in a variety of habitats. There are waterfowl moving, the hawks are migrating, and the small passerine or perching birds are moving through many of the forest lands.
And do all birds migrate?
Not all birds migrate. A lot of the resident birds, quail, pheasants, turkeys, don't migrate. But the high percentage of birds do migrate, as Beth lined out.
And so, Beth, what kinds of birds will we see here in the Bay Area and the South Bay Area in the coming months?
Actually, this is a really good time to see birds, as Brad mentioned. Right now, the raptors and the hawks are migrating through, and clear up through November, we'll see a lot of the raptors. And it's almost like this is a funnel in the flyway, because we're part of the Pacific Flyway. The birds come down to areas where there's a large source of food. Raptors pass through because of not wanting to cross much water, so they funnel into the areas of Marin County. Then they hit San Francisco and disperse again on their way south, where there's food availability for shorebirds. They come through. The bay has a lot of different food sources. Many of them will stay while others go on to the south. And then we'll be seeing waterfowl starting to arrive. This is actually a destination for waterfowl. We hold about 48% of the diving waterfowl in the Pacific Flyway in San Francisco Bay and the adjacent coastal lagoons during the winter months. So it's a good time to get out and see ducks. Also, over in the Central Valley, either in the rice fields, the agricultural fields, it's a good place to see shorebirds. And then waterfowl will fill up the wetland inland areas over there as well.
And what makes California unique when it comes to bird migration?
There's real diversity of habitat here in California. We've got forests, we've got oak woodlands, we have grasslands, We've got wetlands. We've got the ocean. We've got inland estuaries, inland lakes, and mountainous regions. And so there's such diversity in California that we can sustain lots of different species of birds.
And Brad, how long have you been a bird watcher?
It's been a lifelong passion for me, starting off as a teenager, and I was fortunate enough to turn it into a career.
Well, lucky you. So what are some of the major changes you've seen over the years?
Well, actually, some of the most exciting changes are the habitat programs like what Beth is involved with, where you get a local partnership together and start reversing the trends in habitat loss and to more protection, conservation, and management.
What about you, Beth? What have you seen, especially in this area? What has really changed over the years?
I think it's pretty exciting right now in this area, particularly because for a number of years we were seeing habitat decline. And through the partnership, as Brad described, a number of organizations and agencies have come together, developed restoration plans, acquired a lot of habitat, and now we're in the process of doing restoration for birds and other species.
Now, what about global warming? I mean, how is that really affecting bird migration? Are you seeing major changes because of that?
Some of our partners are doing some modeling to identify what will happen with global warming. There's some birds, such as residence birds, such as clapper rails that use the marshes, that are probably going to be pushed higher into the marsh and where we have hard edges around the bay and we don't have adjacent habitat for the marshes to move upland. They could end up either losing their habitat or having to move elsewhere. Some of the other birds, such as common yellowthroat or Sassoon song sparrow, they live in some of the brackish marshes on the inland areas. And as global warming occurs, we're expecting that the bay is going to become much more saline, which means that Sassoon marsh and even the delta will become more saline. We'll probably see some of San Francisco Bay's birds move into the Central Valley.
And is anything being done now to try to tackle this problem before the birds are sort of forced to alter their lifestyles?
There's a lot going on as far as research. Unfortunately, we still don't know enough, so we have to rely on models. Mm. And models, like any models, can always not always be exactly accurate. But what we are doing, some of our partners, such as the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, are doing some modeling to identify where the bay is going to move, what kind of tidal surges, what kind of sedimentation is going to occur in order to know what the habitat changes are going to be. And hopefully we can take some preemptive actions to help protect the largest swath of wetlands and to ensure that we can get the buffer zones that are needed while we're doing the planning right now for some of these large restoration projects.
And we'll talk about some of those restoration projects, specifically the ones in this area, a little later in the show. But Brad, in terms of global warming, what changes have you seen, and what are you doing up in Oregon to tackle this problem?
Well, I work at the flyway level, and we have seen changes already in distribution of some species of birds throughout the flyway. And we are working at this level and trying to coordinate down to the local level, like Beth's joint venture and the other joint ventures, to make sure that we recognize the changes that may occur from climate change, and to make sure that we have developed strategies for, for those predicted changes. As Beth mentioned, we're doing a lot of modeling at this point in time. All models are wrong, but some of them are useful. We probably won't get everything exactly right, but we are trying to be strategic about where we're going with our conservation efforts. So when we get 10 or 15 years down the road, we've thought about where the birds are going to be and what habitats are going to need.
And do they, I mean, this is kind of a strange question, but do they have the capacity to alter their lifestyles? It's been amazing to sort of talk about polar bears and how they've been forced to alter their lifestyles. How do you think birds will cope with this, just based on the patterns that you've studied over the years?
Well, birds, we are talking about highly mobile birds, and many of them have the ability to be be relatively what we as scientists call plastic and change their distribution and seek out habitats. There are other ones, and Beth mentioned a few of them, that don't have that much flexibility in moving to new habitats, you know, that are up or down the coast, but are going to have to retreat as sea level rises, going to have to retreat into new areas. And we're hoping that that we understand their habitats well enough that we can plan for those changes that might take place.
I loved the film Bird Migration. Was that what it was called?
Winged Migration.
Thank you. And it was incredible just to watch how incredibly smart these birds are. And can you give us some examples, Brad, of some of your favorite birds and kind of talk about how they adapt, what their patterns are, what makes them unique?
Well, one of my favorite birds are tundra swans and big white swans that migrate from Alaska down here on down the west coast and also down to the east coast. And they're, you know, so you're talking about a migration of 5,000 kilometers, which is a long ways. And those birds primarily used to be all wetland associated birds, but they have learned to feed in agricultural fields. And so they've adapted to the changing food conditions, and with that have been more successful. They're going back and being more successful in surviving the winter and also of raising larger families.
Hmm. What about you, Beth?
I've got actually a couple of them. I really like the phalaropes. It's a small shore bird. There's several different species of phalaropes here in the Pacific Flyway. One of the things that's unique about phalaropes is that once the female lays the eggs, and it's the male that hatches and feeds the young. And so I think that that's really kind of unique among lot of species. I also am really drawn to seabirds, and particularly because a lot of these are wanderers of the sea. As we're talking about migration, some of these birds never come to shore except to nest and rear young, and then they go back out to sea and wander the seas for the rest of the year until it's time to nest again.
What are some of your favorite places in the area to watch birds?
Oh, it depends upon the kinds of birds I want to go watching. Point Reyes is a wonderful place to watch birds because it's an area that captures a lot of vagrants. These are birds that are often blown off course or miss the flyway, so to speak, and end up, instead of in Asia or Eurasia, come over here to the Pacific. So it's a great place to see some of species that are Asian species that you wouldn't see elsewhere. It's also got such a high diversity because of the different habitat types that you can see well over 100 birds a day there, species of birds a day at Point Reyes. San Francisco Bay is also really unique. And for shorebirds, there's no place like it. Point Reyes Bird Observatory did surveys during the 1980s and 1990s on shorebird migration and populations throughout the entire flyway. And that's when we discovered that we had probably during the peak of migration over 1 million shorebirds a day in San Francisco Bay.
A million? Wow.
During the height of migration.
Wow. If you're just joining us, we are talking about bird migration today, and that is Beth Hunting. She's coordinator with the San Francisco Bay Joint Venture. We're also joined by Brad Bortner. He's joining us from Portland, Oregon. He's chief of the Division of Migratory Birds and Habitat Programs. And we're spending the hour really celebrating bird migration, but then also talking about the reality of what birds face today, both by global warming and human activity. And if you'd like to join us and talk about your stories about birds, if you're an avid bird watcher, we'd love to hear stories from you about where you watch birds, what your favorite birds are, and then we'll dig into the question about what we can do to make sure birds continue their migration. 866-798-8255. This is your call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, San Francisco, your local public radio station. The time is 11:20. Coming up at noon, it's news and notes at 1 o'clock, alternative radio, Gore Vidal on the fall of the United States. And at 2 o'clock, the state we're in, stories from around the world with special focus on human rights issues from Radio Netherlands. That's today at 2 o'clock. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our daily newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we will have a conversation about the New Deal. What can we learn from the New Deal? Were there solutions back then in the 30s that make sense today? And also, how did people at the grassroots level come together to help each other as the Great Depression hit? And then on Wednesday, we're going to take a look at what the second McCain-Obama debate looked like from the most contested states in this year's election. Tomorrow night is the second debate between McCain and Obama, and it'll be carried live here on KALW and also on KUSP in Santa Cruz. What we want to do is talk to people living in the swing states. So if you have relatives or friends living in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Virginia, Minnesota, Colorado, Nevada, we would love to hear from them and connect with them. So if you have friends or relatives, please drop us an email or you can call us. The email is feedback@yourcallradio.org. But if you don't have access to that, you can give us a call at 415-841-4121 and then just hit my extension 3004. And let us know if you've got friends in some of these swing states, because we'd love to catch up with them and connect with them on Wednesday. And if you have a show idea for us or an overall comment, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. But today we are spending the hour talking about bird migration, both celebrating birds and the beauty of birds, and also talking about the reality that birds face today. And we're joined by Beth Hunting. She's coordinator with the San Francisco Bay Joint Venture. That's a partnership for restoring habitat for birds and wildlife. And Brad Bortner. He's chief of the Division of Migratory Birds and Habitat Programs with the Pacific Region U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We'd love to hear from you if you're an avid bird watcher or you just love birds strolling around outside. And what have you seen lately? Where are some of the best spots to see birds? What makes California unique? And then also, what can we do to help restore their habitat? 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Nikki in Salinas. Good morning, Nikki. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi there.
Hi.
I was excited to hear somebody talk about Point Reyes. I used to be a resident of Inverness years ago, and I'm so appreciative of that area. But I currently live in the Central Coast, actually in North San Luis Obispo County, in a very sparsely populated area. And I work in this area farther north, which is in Monterey County. But I'm in the I work in the agricultural area. One of the things that I really notice, because I love birds and I live on 3.5 acres where I'm visited by hawks and their families and quail, and I mean we have lots of birds on our property. Seems like an abundance. I've only been there 5 years, but it seems like there's more every year. But I really notice a dearth of birds in this agricultural area where I'm working, which is the southern Monterey County. Is that pesticide and agriculture related, do you think, or is it just happened to be an anecdotal thing that I'm seeing?
All right, thanks for calling in. Mm-hmm. Beth, what do you think? What could be the cause of that?
Could be several things. If you're in an agricultural area where you're growing just a limited number of crops, it could have to do with lack of diverse habitats. It's almost like a cornfield is a monoculture. That could be a possibility. Also, there is high pesticide use down in the Salinas Valley and in that area. It could be related to pesticides.
How do pesticides affect birds?
Well, it kills off a lot of the food. A lot. The birds are dependent upon a variety of food sources, insects, and in seed-eating birds, a lot of the herbicides will also reduce the diversity of plant material that's available for food as well. So it could be a number of different things. Also, there may be better habitat elsewhere. They may just be bypassing an area and looking for better habitat.
Brad, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think Beth nailed that one pretty well. I would think that it's probably the lack of the diverse habitats and also agricultural fields under intense management don't have the insects and the weed seeds that a lot of birds really enjoy.
All right. Thank you for calling, Nikki. Let's hear from Leslie in Berkeley. Hi, Leslie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. This is particularly for Beth and Brad to focus on the Suzun Marsh. I No, it's protected by a Susan Marsh Protection Plan, but it seems to be threatened by an expanded dump that's applying for new permits for expansion before BCDC, the Bay Conservation and Development Commission. And there's also adjacent to the Susan Marsh a site called the Montezuma Wetlands Restoration Project, which if anybody ever went out there, and hardly anybody ever does, it's contamination from the lower San Francisco Bay.
Mm.
And it is like a barren wasteland at this point. And I just wonder if the foxes are watching the chicken coop. It seems that this whole area, which, Brad, you should know, is a serious migratory stopping place for the Pacific Flyway, is kind of being covered up as a hot zone for contaminated runoff, particularly from the dump site, which is being expanded. There's plastic baggies blowing all over in the wind, mm-hmm. and who knows what's coming down through the waterways. And I should think anybody concerned about water quality in the Bay Area should start paying attention to the Susan Marsh, and that the Susan Marsh Protection Plan is not a guiding, strong enough plan for a very serious hot zone. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Leslie. Now, I just looked this up online. The Susan Marsh it's 116,000 acres and includes 52,000 acres of managed wetlands. Brad, you're familiar with this and the restoration process?
I'm very familiar with the Sassoon Marsh, and it is an area of historic of waterfowl use and important wetlands. I'm not personally familiar with the issue that she brought up in the Montezuma wetlands and some of the changes, but I would I would defer to Beth since she's dealing at a much closer scale than I am.
Okay. And then also for people who aren't familiar with it, it's located in southern Solano County, which is about 35 miles northeast of San Francisco.
Yes.
Okay.
It's actually part of the confluence between the Bay, the Delta. It's the largest brackish marsh on the west coast of North America. So it's got fresh water as well as tidal influences there. And the caller is right that the Sassoon Marsh Preservation Act is only a start towards preserving Sassoon Marsh. The area historically has had high waterfowl populations. There are a lot of duck clubs out there. A lot of it's privately owned. And then there are issues such as the dump. And unfortunately, the regulatory process is a process for permitting activities that are either going on or expanding there. This dump has been highly controversial. It's definitely a source of pollution. A number of the various NGO organizations, non-governmental organizations, have been very active in trying to stop the dump. It's definitely an issue. The other problem out there that she mentioned, the Montezuma Wetlands, this was the first wetlands restoration project that reused dredge materials. Most of the dredge materials that are going into a lot of these wetland restoration sites are fairly clean dredge materials, but it really depends upon the construction of the wetland itself. And so if the restoration design doesn't have the proper channels, or it's designed in a way that doesn't necessarily mimic nature, the functionality of that wetland is going to be compromised.
Hmm. Now, are budget cuts a factor here? Has that trickled down to restoration efforts?
There are budget cuts are definitely a challenge. It's primarily not the actual construction of the restoration that's suffering from budget cuts so much as the long-term management. For instance, the California Department of Fish and Game, which owns a Grizzly Island and a number of the areas within Sassoon Marsh, the Napa Sonoma Marshes in the North Bay, Eden Landing in the South Bay, they're operating right now on an operating budget of less than $1 per acre on an annual basis for everything that they own. And so it's really difficult in order to manage these areas with such a limited budget.
A dollar per acre, what do they need to do the work they need to do on a regular basis? What would the amount be?
Well, that basically just covers the salaries of about three people to cover this mm-hmm. entire area. So that's not nearly enough. What mm-hmm. we're finding is happening is that a lot of the floodgates, tidal gates, and some of the managed wetlands are suffering because they don't have the resources in order to manage these areas for anything other than the bare minimum.
All right. Thank you so much for calling in, Leslie. And we'll put a link to information about the Sassoon Marsh on the website after the show at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Justin in Santa Cruz. Good morning, Justin.
Good morning. Hey, I just had a quick question. I was, I've been born and raised out here in the Santa Cruz Mountains in Boulder Creek. And when I was a kid, you know, you'd very rarely see crows. You know, they were kind of, you know, even smaller than they are now. And I've always kind of liked them because they were just kind of rare. But now that I've noticed, you know, I'm 39 now, and it seems like there's just a lot more crows around. And I was just wondering, and they're big. They're like these big ones now. I'm just wondering, where do they come from? What's up with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. Beth?
Yeah, there are more crows around because they're very opportunistic birds. Unfortunately, when habitats are changed, some of the other species that inhabit a particular area are either not habiting or inhabiting the area anymore. They're sensitive to people and populations. Crows are very adaptable. They're part of what we call the corvid family that includes crows, jays, magpies, and they do take advantage of a situation. They're very easily adaptable to human beings. As far as the size going, you're probably also looking at ravens because they're part of the crow world and they are the larger bird.
So they're not getting bigger.
Brad, do you know if crows are getting any bigger?
The birds aren't getting bigger. I suspect that Beth is exactly right, that the large ones he's talking about are ravens. And raven and crow populations have been increasing because they are so flexible. They find food sources in, you know, city dumps and other places like that that they wouldn't have found food historically. And has increased populations in some locations, to the point of where they're actually becoming pests and causing problems for other species.
If you're just joining us, we are spending the hour talking about bird migration, and the migration season is in full force right now here in California and actually across the country. And we're joined today by Brad Bortner. He's chief of the Division of Migratory Birds and Habitat Programs. He's joining us from Portland, Oregon. And then joining us here in studio is Beth Hunning. She's coordinator with the San Francisco Bay Joint Venture. That's a partnership for restoring habitat for birds and wildlife. And if you'd like to join us, if you have a question for Beth or Brad about birds and some changes that you've seen over the years, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Also, if you're an avid bird watcher and you have some special stories or memories you'd like to share, we'd love to hear those as well. And then the other question, we'll talk about this in just a minute, human interaction. How are humans affecting bird migrations, and what can we do to help restore their habitat and make sure that we really don't ruin that migration? Toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And thank you for calling in, Justin. Let's hear from Judy in Redwood City. Good morning, Judy.
Hi. I'm volunteering with a group of local citizens to try and protect open space in our city. And we've got a ballot initiative. We've got an initiative on the ballot in November that will do that, that will require the city council to take to the citizens to get a two-thirds vote if they try to change any open space uses or parks uses. And there's a big, Cargill owns a very large property on the bayfront, 1,400 acres, and it's in danger of being developed. And this is a really important campaign, and we need lots of support, and this is such a great show, and those acres are very restorable, and we would certainly like to make that happen.
Well, thank you. And that is Measure W?
Measure W in Redwood City.
Okay.
Get more information from Save the Bay or redwoodcityopenspace.org.
Okay, thank you. And we'll put information about that also on the website. But Brad, how does sparsely populated areas, we heard from Nikki earlier, and then also development, how does that affect bird migration?
Well, it's not only bird migration. I'm going to answer the question in that human development and development or destruction of habitat is probably the biggest threat to migratory birds not just interfering with their migration, but also interfering with the size of the populations. And as we talked a little bit about with the crow and raven question, is that there are species that are benefiting from growing human populations, but there are also a lot of species that are not benefiting and are declining because of the loss of habitat or the changes people are bringing to the landscape.
And in the Central Valley, Beth, that area is developing by leaps and bounds on a regular basis. How is that affecting bird migration?
The Central Valley historically was an area of grasslands and large wetland tracts. And 100 years ago, the sky was just black with birds.
Mm.
There are times when the birds are in certain locations where there's still good habitat in some of the national wildlife refuges and the state fish and game areas, and even some of the agricultural rice fields where large concentrations of birds can be found during the winter months. But with the agricultural development and the need and the urban development that's occurring there, water is being taken out of the wetlands and being used for other purposes. Right now, the refuges, the National Wildlife Refuges in the area and the fish and game properties have to buy water at the going rate, and so it's becoming more expensive for them to manage the lands. In the meantime, urbanization is taking over the habitat. And so what we're seeing is, although the Central Valley Joint Venture and a number of the partners that are working to put back habitat in that area are meeting with good success, the habitat's being fragmented by urbanization and the lack of water.
Well, and then also, I think this is connected when you look at new technologies being developed for new forms of energy, specifically wind power. How are, for example, wind power and the wind turbines, how are those affecting birds? And do you think that as they increase in size, we'll see some problems?
Well, there are problems now. Brad, do you want to go on that? I heard...
Brad. There are lots of threats to birds from a variety of human caused infrastructure, whether it's power lines or wind turbines, and I think what the take home message that I'd like all of your listeners to have is that while there are threats, they can be controlled somewhat if wind power turbines are placed in the proper locations, if power lines are put in the proper locations. If you run a power line across a heavy concentrated of bird area like a refuge, they provide, it's places where birds can hit the power lines. There we call them line strikes, and it ends up in mortality or injuries to lots of birds. The same can happen with wind power. Fortunately, the power line community, also the wind power community, is aware of those impacts and is doing more and more in doing studies about proper siting and changes in technology. You go to some places now and you'll see that they have flashers or little spinning of balls and other things on power lines to increase the visibilities for birds. A lot of the changes in the wind power technology with nice clean towers instead of the old lattice type towers where there was lots of perching surfaces, they're having less impact on birds. It's a continual place where we're working with industry to try to minimize the take minimize the injury to birds, but it's kind of a never-ending battle.
Yeah, and it seems like those decisions would have to be made now because things are moving so quickly.
Right. We and the Fish and Wildlife Service and a lot of our state and private partners are working with industries to try to influence them and make sure that we are getting them sited in the right locations, doing the studies up front. We have mapped where the wind power industry has mapped the entire United States on where there is commercially viable wind power, and we are trying to work with them to identify which of those areas have the least conflict with birds.
Beth, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I think Brad really hit on it when he said location and design.
Part of the problem that they discovered with the Altamont location of that wind farm out at Altamont Pass is that because there are high winds out there, it's also a flyway. Unfortunately, there were a lot of the turbines that were set up there. There were a lot of raptor crashes and owls out there. So it's really important to locate these in areas that may still have high wind areas, but not necessarily the main migratory routes, such as this one. The other thing that a number of the cities are starting to do, I think Toronto was the first city, Chicago, and then I just heard this weekend that Boston has joined these cities in cutting back on their lights on their tall buildings at night. A lot of the songbirds migrate at night. They follow the stars. They can get confused by lights on buildings, and there are a lot of crashes on these high buildings. And so a number of these built cities now are doing that. And I would encourage San Francisco to consider joining these other cities and being a leader.
Yeah, that's an incredible visual. Do you think that that's on the radar screens of other states or cities across the country?
I don't know what other cities are.
So it's Boston,
Toronto, and Chicago so far. But it also saves on energy.
Right. And so then the birds don't smash into the window. It seems kind of like a no-brainer.
Or it certainly reduces the number of birds smashing into the windows.
Well, I'll get information about that and from you after the show, and we'll put up information on the website.
Yeah, there is a website called Fatal Light Awareness Program, and I encourage people to go to that to learn about that.
All right. And do you think that's gaining traction?
Excuse me?
Is that gaining traction, the Fatal Light Awareness Program?
It's a website where they have they try to raise the visibility of that that issue of how lights on buildings and structures can lead to bird mortality.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you again for calling in, Judy. Your question raised a number of other issues. And if you'd like to join us, we have just over 10 minutes left. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you're just joining us, we're talking about bird migration. And if you have a question for Beth Hunting or Brad Bortner, feel free to give us a call. If you're an avid bird watcher, we'd love to hear from you. You can talk about some of your favorite places to watch birds. And then also, we're talking about some steps that we can actually take to really try not to affect the migratory pattern of birds, and then also make sure that they're not killed in the process of these new technologies that are coming up on a regular basis. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Ted in San Francisco. Hi, Ted. Thanks for holding.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Enjoy the program. I just wanted to relate an inspiring experience over the weekend at the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival, where in the past the Blue Angels have invaded the airspace.
Right.
But we were much relieved and refreshed to see flocks of geese flying over the main stage to great acclaim and comment from the stage.
Oh, that's great. And did everybody cheer?
Oh, yeah. And many of the well-known artists like Emmylou Harris and Steve Earle made light of how much more pleasure there was in this.
So the birds took over from the Blue Angels this year.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing that, Ted.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you. And if you'd like to join us, the number is 866-798-8255. So let's spend the rest of the show really talking about what we can do, humans can do, to make sure we don't get in the way of these migratory patterns. So we talked about this Fatal Light Awareness Program, for example. Are there any other restoration efforts that we should know about that are going on in this area, Beth?
Actually, San Francisco Bay has one of the largest restoration programs anywhere in the country right now. We'd identified wetlands in San Francisco Bay as one of the key habitats for waterfowl as well as for shorebirds. And because of the altered bay ecosystem that's occurred over the last 125 years or so, there is an opportunity now to reverse the trend and at least try to bring back some ecological functions here in the bay. So the San Francisco Bay Joint Venture is a partnership that includes a number of the federal agencies, such as the Fish and Wildlife Service, the State Department of Fish and Game, the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, because they are regulating both development as well as restoration, the Army Corps of Engineers, a number of our agency partners, and then we also bring together some of the non-governmental organizations, such as Point Reyes Bird Observatory, that does a lot of the research on birds in the bay, Ducks Unlimited, which is a large organization that does a lot of wetlands restoration, and a number of our other regional partners, as well as the business community, to try to bring back San Francisco Bay wetlands. And so we've got a target of about 200,000 acres, about 100,000 which are tidal wetlands, and then we've also got riparian areas, seasonal wetlands, and other types of wetland habitats that we have targeted to try to restore. And we've got right now about three of the four largest restoration projects in the country happening right here.
And do you work with volunteers?
Some of the organizations do work with volunteers.
So if we want to get involved,
yes,
that's possible.
If you want to get involved, go to our website, www.sfbayjv.org, and it'll link to all of our different partner organizations. We've also post their volunteer opportunities on our website.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. Let's hear from our next caller, Stephen in San Francisco. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. I have a question. I'm sort of new to birding. I've been doing this now for about a year. And in San Francisco, I've seen a great variety of birds. But I always go in different areas, different parks, looking for certain birds. And I always find something that I'm not looking for. But I'm wondering if you know of resources or lists online where you can sort of help people who are interested in birding find or best places to go to find particular types of birds, maybe. And I have one other question. I have a birdhouse that I built, and I have birdseed, which I like to feed, like, finches that come to my window. And if you have any recommendations to keep, like, say, song sparrows away, which seem to, or house sparrows away, which seem to, are kind of aggressive and seem to dominate.
And, Stephen, you said you're a relatively new urban birder?
Yeah.
What attracts you to birding?
Well, a lot of things. So birds the design of the bird is amazing. They're different behaviors. Some of them, I mean, I first started reading a book called The Mind of the Raven by Bernd Heinrich, and how intelligent these birds are. And you can watch them do different things, almost play games. And you realize that every bird has these great inventions, and they're so capable of different things. And as you bird, and it's more compelling as you do it. These birds seem to be much more aware of us than we are of them. I mean, we're much more of a threat to them. And as you sort of get into the zone as you bird, they seem to really, they show themselves more. And maybe that's just psychological, but that's sort of my take on it. They seem to be aware of your intent or something like that.
Huh. Well, that's why I love the documentary Winged Migration. If you haven't seen it yet, definitely check it out. It was incredible.
I love it. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, thank you for calling. And on the website, I did find an article called Where Do You Want to Go Birding in California Today? And there's a number of recommendations for bird watchers. And Beth, do you have any other recommendations?
There are a number of local birding groups. You might start with the Audubon Society. There are 7 or 8 chapters here in the Bay Area. They run field trips on a weekly basis, if not more often. So Golden Gate Audubon is the Audubon Society here in San Francisco. Also, a number of our NGO partners that I mentioned earlier, such as Point Reyes Bird Observatory, have outings. The Golden Gate Raptor Observatory. You can watch hawks up at Hawk Hill right now. And then also the San Francisco Bay Bird Observatory down in the South Bay runs birding outings.
Okay, great. Thank you. And we will put all of these links on the website right after the show. Thanks for calling, Stephen. Let's hear from Noelle in Watsonville. Hi, Noelle.
Hi there. Yeah, I'm calling from Watsonville, California, which is a town about 20 miles south of Santa Cruz, and I just wanted to comment on some interesting restoration that's taking place down here. I work for a nonprofit called the Watsonville Wetlands Watch, and currently we're working on restoration projects on about 800 acres of freshwater sloughs, and we're partnering with the city of Watsonville, and there are plenty of birding opportunities out here. We just finished the Monterey Birding Festival, which was in downtown Watsonville, and great opportunities to see white pelicans and tons of raptors, and there's trails that go all around the sloughs, and it's a project that's been going on that's been basically stimulated by local activists and avid birders, and we're just trying to get the word out that there's this whole sort of hidden treasure down here in Watsonville that's worth discovering.
Yeah, that's great. And is there a website we can check out for people who are interested in visiting?
Sure. The WatsonvilleWetlandsWatch.org.
Watsonville Wetlands Watch. Okay. Great. Thanks for calling in, Noelle.
Sure.
And Beth mentioned right before Noelle's call Hawk Hill, and that's in the Marin Headlands.
Yes.
So if we want to go check out Hawks. So is now a really good time to do that?
Actually, November's probably the best, but they're coming through now.
Great. Right after the election, let's go check out the Hawks. Thank you. Thanks for calling in, Noelle. Brad, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, Rose. I was going to shamelessly plug going to fws.gov, which is the Fish and Wildlife Service's web page, and if you click on the refuges link, you can find out where national wildlife refuges are in your area. You've got the Bay Area, you've got the San Francisco Bay Refuge there. If you wanted to get into the Central Valley, there are a number of refuges there. Everybody ought to go to Twilight and watch the fly off of ducks and geese off of Sacramento National Wildlife Refuge at some point. A spectacular flight of ducks and geese out of the refuge at sundown.
I'm glad. I'm glad that Brad mentioned the Fish and Wildlife Service and the refuges, because we've got the largest urban national wildlife refuge in the country here with the San Francisco Bay National Wildlife Refuge. There are several different sites that are part of that refuge complex, the Don Edwards in the South Bay. There's a visitor center there, and people are welcome to come and watch the birds from that site, and there are periodic education programs. They do a lot with schools. In the North Bay, the San Pablo Bay National Wildlife Refuge also has some school programs, and the refuges are really a fabulous resource. The Fish and Wildlife Service supports the birding festival that usually happens in the first weekend of February. It's the San Francisco Bay Flyway Festival, and we'd like to encourage as many people as can make it out to come out to Mare Island, which is where the birding festival originates. But there are tours led by volunteers and by expert bird watchers, as well as programs and exhibits that go on all through the weekend. And I have to admit that I'm not sure exactly what the date is this year.
Okay, we'll check it out. We'll look it up. Thank you for calling in, Noelle. And also, Tony called in to recommend Brooks Island over in Richmond. So we'll also put a link to that. And we have time for just a few last calls. Let's hear from, or one more call. Let's hear from LJ in Tiburon. Hi, LJ.
Hello. I have a way to protect birds from the props on the wind power, and that is to place whistles that mimic a danger zone that are propelled by, that's worked by air. As they turn around, they will give the signal to the birds.
Oh, that's interesting. Is that being done, do you know?
Well, you know, I've thought about it for a few years. I haven't patented it yet, but I know how to make the whistles.
All right. Well, Brad, what do you think about that?
Well, to tell you the truth, there actually has been some research on that, and also different painting schemes for the blades to make the blades more visible to birds. The problem we always run into is that, well, we can probably make the blades more visible or more audible for the birds. It also are more visible and more audible for people, and the neighbors and places don't like either seeing the blades turn when they get, you know, painting schemes, or the whistle, the sound of the whistle. So we're continuing to work on that. Our biggest biggest success has been making sure that we have them in the right location.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, LJ. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you briefly, how effective is public policy in protecting birds and migration? And is there anything moving around in D.C. that we need to know about right now? Beth?
Public policy actually is absolutely critical and vital. This started with the Neotropical, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which protects migratory birds and actually all species of native birds. And consequently, as a result of the act, this is probably part of the reason that bird populations still are somewhat stable. There are a lot of programs that are designed to protect birds, such as the Neotropical Migratory Bird Act, which provides money for habitat restoration for songbirds, as well as the North American Wetlands Conservation Act, which provides funding for wetlands restoration. And so there are, it's really important that public policy be an avid role here. A lot of decisions are made at the local level, however, and so this is a place that public policy is really critical. This is where land use decisions take place, and the habitats are highly affected by local decisions. And so it's really important for people that care about birds to be involved in local issues.
And Governor Schwarzenegger just signed and vetoed a number of bills over the past week. Were there any that affect birds or migration at all?
Some of them affect them indirectly. One of them was a volunteer labor bill. Up until recently, volunteers had been allowed to be involved in restoration projects. But a number of the organizations, once the caller mentioned about volunteer opportunities, a number of these organizations were using volunteers, and there had been a move afoot to ensure that they be paid union wages, which meant that a lot of these restoration projects weren't going to get done. Mm. So he did sign that bill.
And Brad?
Rose, one thing that everything...
We have about 30 seconds.
One thing that every person can do to help birds is to buy a duck stamp. Mm-hmm. And if you can go through the Postal Service, you can get a duck stamp, and that money goes directly to habitat acquisition.
Oh, duck stamp's kind of like the breast cancer stamp?
Kind of like what?
The breast cancer stamp?
Yes, it goes back to 1934. During the Great Dust Bowl, they created a stamp for all hunters, but anyone can buy a duck stamp, and the money all goes to refuge acquisition.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, very important thing to do.
Great. All right.
So you can get that on the Fish and Wildlife Service website.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it there. Beth Hunting is coordinator with the San Francisco Bay Joint Venture, and Brad Bortner is chief of the Division of Migratory Birds and Habitat Programs. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you who called in. Be sure to check the website, yourcallradio.org, for more information. I'll be right back to let you know what's coming up tomorrow. What can we learn from the New Deal? On the next Your Call, we'll spend the hour looking at the history of the New Deal and the U.S. economy in the 1930s. The phrase New Deal has come to symbolize the sweeping legislation that was introduced to lift the country out of recession. Were there solutions back then that would make sense today? How did people at the grassroots come together to help each other as the Great Depression hit? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW and the friends of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our daily newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find a link to the Your Call podcast. Malihe Razazan is producer, Ben Temption is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
California now has the largest prison system in the nation, but it ran out of space a long time ago. After years of neglect, California's prisons are now dangerously overcrowded. How did it happen? Find out by listening to Prisons in Crisis, a special one-hour program, 1 o'clock and 9 o'clock on Tuesday, October 7th, here on 91.7 KALW, San Francisco.
KALW is proud to present David Sedaris, NPR humorist and author of When You Are Engulfed in Flames and Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim, live for one night only, Monday, October 27th at 8 p.m. at the War Memorial Opera House. Tickets and information, 415-392-4400 or cityboxoffice.com. This is your local